We are so fortunate to have fascinating birds that stay with us the year round and a whole lot more who spend their summers in Wisconsin. But this time of year, many of those species are getting ready to head south for winter. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us and spending your holiday with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We love when we get the chance to talk about birds on our holidays with some really experienced birders. Bill Volkert, one of them, has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years and spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horican Marsh. Bill, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry, and a real pleasure to be with you again.
Well, and Tom Schultz with us as well. Tom's a well-known wildlife artist. He's illustrated several field guides to birds. He's served as the field trip leader for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, served for several years as a member of the steering committee of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project, lives in Green Lake. And Tom, thank you for coming back. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you with us. And certainly a pleasure to have you listening in. And as you listen in and have a question about birds, I hope you'll join in, maybe about migration. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And already a couple callers online. Really a sad anniversary of the death of America's last passenger pigeon. A sad commemoration to be sure today. Tom, can you have the inscription on the passenger pigeon monument at Wyalusing State Park, which in itself is kind of interesting that that was placed there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a neat place to visit. It's a wonderful area to see the overlook the Wisconsin River and Mississippi River confluence.
And what was the and what does the monument say?
Well, this monument was dedicated in 1947, and the plaque on the monument reads, "Dedicated to the last Wisconsin passenger pigeon, shot at Babcock, September 1899. The species became extinct through the avarice and thoughtlessness of man."
Yeah, and Bill Volkert, the passenger, it's amazing to me that we could actually caused that bird to be extinct, given how common they were.
Well, not just common, but probably the most abundant bird to have ever lived in North America and perhaps on the planet. The best estimate is that in the 1800s, they numbered somewhere between at least 3 and 5 billion, and there are just endless tales of the massive migrations of the birds where a single flock would stretch from one end of the horizon all the way as far as you could see and sometimes kept coming for 5 to 7 days straight, and in numbers where they would actually block out the sun in the middle of the day.
Yeah, and pretty much, as the plaque says, the extinction was caused by man.
Yes, and it was probably a number of factors that led to it, but I think the short of it is that the birds nested in massive colonies. In a sense, this helped to synchronize the nesting. They didn't nest alone and probably needed each other nearby just to get into that whole behavior of nesting, which also made them incredibly vulnerable. They were seen as easy to get and very cheap food. And what really led to the demise was the invention of telegraph and railroads. And what that meant is that very quickly people could identify where the birds were nesting, and these large colonies would actually move in to one place for a single season and just devastate the food supply and then move somewhere else all throughout the Midwest. While the hunters could find where they were, they could travel there and they could shoot all they wanted, pack them up, and then ship them for the market just as readily. And what seemed to really have led to the demise of the bird was not that we just shot every last one, but this constant harassment that we disrupted their ability to nest, just going into these nesting colonies and certainly shooting a large proportion of the birds, but also keeping the rest of them from ever rearing any young. And you do that for 25, 30 years, and in the end, if they're not replacing themselves and we're wiping them out in just whole-scale measures, eventually they just disappeared in the wild. And the largest nesting ever recorded occurred in Wisconsin. Now, no doubt there probably were somewhat similar nestings to be found throughout North America, but it was actually in Wisconsin where it was documented in 1871. And I actually posted on your Facebook page a map taken from the researcher into all of this, Arlen William Shorger from the University in Madison. A.W. Shorger, or Bill Shorger as he liked to be called, did a very extensive research on the history of the bird. And what he did is he looked at every single published newspaper in Wisconsin through whenever they began, somewhere in the 1800s through 1899. And those documentations of any wildlife sighting is what he compiled and actually wrote the authoritative book on the natural history of the passenger pigeon. And what we saw was 1871, we estimate 136 million passenger pigeons nested in central Wisconsin.
Wow.
In September 1899, as Tom mentioned, the last one was shot at Babcock, somewhere between the 9th and 15th of the month in September. And then, as the birds were disappearing, a few were gathered up for displays in the zoos. Milwaukee had a small display, and a few others around the country. And, of course, those birds, they never bred in captivity. One by one, in the early 1900s, they started to die. Cincinnati had the last of them. I think it was about five birds. And by about 1910, the last of the males died. One single bird continued. She lived to be 27 years old. And it was on this very day, September 1st, around about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, which would actually be Eastern time.
Mm-hmm.
So at noon today, the zookeeper walked in and found that single bird called Martha, named after Martha Washington, lying dead on a cage.
Yeah.
And so it was not just a single bird that perished, literally the last of her kind. And while we have had other extinctions, the dodo is certainly well known, the great auk, Labrador duck, Carolina parakeets, these are all birds that disappeared in historic times. The bastard pigeon probably was the most dramatic because here was a bird so incredibly abundant that people didn't think that we could even put a dent in the population, much less wipe it out. And yet, in one way, if there's anything positive to be said of this, it was such a dramatic extinction that the most abundant bird in the planet could be wiped out. I think it underscores the point that if we didn't institute some sort of an ethic, a conservation movement that had to get going out of necessity, nothing stood a chance. Because if we could wipe out passenger pigeons, what else?
So that really was the start of the modern conservation movement, you're saying?
It was the impetus. It got it going. So if there's any good that came out of it, it was certainly that we took a second look and realized we have to institute on ourselves some sort of an ethic and some restraints, because if we can wipe out passenger pigeons, we could wipe out anything out there. And so that is really the whole legacy, and conservation as such got started in North America. So out of a very sad event that we will never see passenger pigeons, and in fact now, 100 years after the passing of the last one, there probably isn't anybody alive anymore who's ever seen a passenger pigeon. We lost that bird, but it got us to take a really close look at everything else and really dedicate an effort to try to make sure that nothing else would disappear. And that's really what conservation is about these days.
And Tom, on the other hand, we have, I mean, that's a sad, sad story. But we have some exciting news to share as well. Can you have some news about confirming the first ever breeding pair of a very beautiful bird in Wisconsin? What'd you see?
Well, it's a bird, a member of the heron family that's called the white-faced ibis. And we've had records of white-faced ibis for a number of years. It's nothing unusual, especially at Horicon Marsh. In fact, its close relative, close cousin, the glossy ibis, has also been observed. But about 3 years ago, white-faced ibis were found at a small wetland in southwestern Winnebago County. And we've seen several birds there each of the last 3 years. And they showed up again this last May. And I always sort of wondered why wouldn't they nest?
Mm-hmm.
But they are colonial species, so perhaps it takes a colony to establish a nest. But anyway, about 3 weeks ago, I was able to observe a juvenile white-faced ibis at this site. It's called the Maskootin Trail Wetland. It's a bike trail, hiking trail that goes between Berlin and Ripon. And then probably a few days later, I was back there another time and happened to observe food begging and feeding behavior, where this young bird was begging with adults. And usually that's a pretty good sign that it's a young dependent bird of the year. And so many of us feel that this confirmed actual nesting. The first time
that's pretty cool.
Breeding of the species has been observed in Wisconsin.
Where do they usually breed?
They're mainly along the Texas to New Mexico area, farther southern U.S. The glossy ibis kind of extend east from there into Florida, but they aren't that common in the northern part of the states.
What do you think that is? This possibly a maybe it's just a one and done event, but might this be the start of a more permanent condition?
That's entirely possible, and only time will tell. But, you know, we think of climate change and global warming, and some species are extending their ranges further northward. And, you know, all the colonies have to start somewhere. So it's possible that it could lead to a range expansion.
Well, we have, that's really good news. And we have lots of callers online with questions for you guys. And I think we'll just go to the phones and find out what's on people's minds. Marge in Green Bay up first. Marge, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, well, thank you for having the program.
What can we do for you?
Well, I had a couple things I wanted to share. I saw two immature red-tailed hawks out at the Pulliam plant area here in Green Bay, okay, this
cool.
summer.
Good.
And I wanted to know when the orioles are going to take off and go south for the winter.
Okay. Bill Volkert?
Well, orioles, this will be the time of year that they're getting ready to depart. And one of the problems about the fall departure is that it's a lot less noticed than, say, spring arrival. First of all, the birds are quite silent this time of year. They've been raising their young. They're not calling that much. The leaves are still very dense in the trees, and orioles tend to be a real treetop bird. And where it's really easy to recognize the day in spring, usually that first week of May, when the first ones show up, it's always in retrospect that you realize that, well, I haven't seen them for a while, so they may have left. So it's a sort of silent departure. But as we get through September now, this will be the time of year. And remember, birds are leaving in anticipation of a food shortage. So our orioles are insect eaters. They've got to slowly get ready now, pack up, and start heading south before we get into the first killing frost, which will happen here probably in the next month and a half. So there's an anticipation of that. And so somewhere around that mid-late September, we start seeing that departure or noticing that they haven't been around for some time. So, yeah, they're getting ready to go. The young are all full grown. I've had them coming to my hummingbird feeders very actively and almost aggressively. And whether they're just enjoying the food or actually starting to fatten up a little bit, that and everything else, getting ready for their departure, it's just shortly around the corner.
There you go.
Yeah, they're just like fleas on a dog's back out here in my grape jelly feeder.
Lucky
well,
you.
Had a really good nesting season nearby, and same here. I've noticed as many as five of them at any one time, so a family or two for sure.
I haven't had a single one this summer. Mm. First time ever. And it's sad. I really miss them. I hear them in the neighborhood, but I've heard a few in the neighborhood, but I just haven't gotten them to my feeders, unfortunately.
I thought I'd mention a couple of things about fall bird migration, Larry.
Yeah.
One is that a lot of the birds that we see here in the summertime as breeders or later on as migrants tend to move on tailwinds. And so that tends to mean that in the fall time, they're moving on a cold front when there's a wind blowing from the north. Because it makes perfect sense, too. If the bird flies at, say, 25 miles an hour and he's got a tailwind of 25 miles an hour, he can get a ground speed of 50 miles an hour. So he could make pretty good progress. And then also I wanted to mention that a lot of our birds, large number of our birds are nocturnal migrants, and they do their migrating through the nighttime hours. And a lot of times you have these cold fronts that'll come through, and one day you'll see the birds there, the next day the same ones will be gone. Or on the other hand, you may suddenly have arrivals, new arrivals of birds coming from the north. At this time of year, it's start of warbler migration, so a lot of the warblers will start showing up very suddenly after the passage of a cold front.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you again, Marge, for calling, by the way. Appreciate your call, and appreciate you as well. Give us a call with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest today, Bill Volkert, naturalist and retired wildlife educator at Horicon International Education Center, and Tom Schultz, well-known wildlife artist who has illustrated several field guides for birds and field trip leader for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in as we talk birds with our two guests today, Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz. Tom, a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh. Always great to have these guys come by. And Al in Vilas County has been waiting patiently, so let's go to Al. Hi, thank you for waiting.
Hi, thanks for the show. The loon, my favorite bird. My family has a place up on the Cisco chain here, and I have a learned friend who belongs to the Wisconsin Loon Watch. And this is pretty disconcerting, but here's what's happening with our loons. 80% of them were driven off their nests by those nasty invasive flies. Half of those returned again to try and nest, and who knows how that went. Then all our loons migrate through Lake Michigan from up here, and they found many dead loons on the shore of Lake Michigan last year because of botulism, because they eat the gobies, because the quagga mussels and the zebra mussels are filter feeders, so more sunlight gets through and creates this botulism on the bottom of the lake. The gobies eat it, the loons eat the gobies, and then they die. I'm really worried that they're going to get wiped out for this part of the state of Wisconsin for next year, because I've been watching them my whole life, and I hope you can give me some good news. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks, Al, for calling. Well, maybe comments from both. Bill Volker, will turn to you first.
Sure. Yeah, this event of the botulism die-off, it's been noted for about the last 5 or 6 years. It's not every year, and so it's somewhat episodic, and the degree of it also, whether it happens or not, or whether it's a severe year or a somewhat mild one, that kind of comes and goes with different conditions. But it is a new event, and you're exactly right as to the chain reaction of what's happening as those birds are moving to Lake Michigan to feed. Actually, we've had a number of loons in northern Wisconsin on radio transmitters, and we take a look at where they're moving. Some of them go to some of the larger lakes in northern Wisconsin and then head south. Some do head to Lake Michigan, but it's not the case that all of them necessarily do. Despite the fact that we've had some of these die-offs, it actually turns out that Wisconsin loon population has been increasing. These are long-lived birds. They don't produce a lot of young. It takes a while for them to mature, but there has been a slight increase of the population over the years, and with that, we actually see the loon range slowly expanding as some of the young are coming back. Now, the one thing to keep in mind is that they're very territorial and very traditional, so the same pair come back to the same lake year after year, which could mean that if something happens to that one pair, you have a local loss of those birds. But you can't measure the entire statewide population of just what happens on a single lake or two. So, yeah, it is a concern about this impact from the botulism. We think that it's also hitting loons that are coming down from Canada, so it's more the impact on a continental population, not just our statewide population. I'm not meaning to dismiss it. Yes, it is a concern, but it doesn't seem to have a significant impact to the overall population. And Wisconsin, they're more than hanging in there. They seem to actually be slowly increasing in numbers.
And just to kind of go along with that, there was a Facebook question from Bob, and I think you've answered a good share of his questions. He was wondering about the young this year. But he wondered if when the parents head south, do they leave the young behind for another few weeks? Or
They actually do migrate independently, and the young will head south. They're either going off the South Atlantic or a lot of them to the Gulf, and then they hang out there for several years until they mature, and then they come back.
Very
unusual habits.
Very interesting. Ed in Phillips, Wisconsin, your turn. Thanks for calling, Ed.
Thank you. By the way, a great program and very interesting, and I find myself watching public TV and public radio more and more all the time. Both of my vehicles have the public radio station on them. Here's my quick question. I think I had a ladderback woodpecker in my yard about 2 years ago, 2.5, 3 years ago. It was here for a couple years. I don't know if it had a mate or if it had raised young, but everything in my bird book shows it had to be a ladderback. It's similar to a red-bellied woodpecker. But in my old bird book, the ladderback is only supposed to be located in the New Mexico, Arizona, and in Mexico. What do you think I possibly had in my yard? And it wasn't a flicker, but it sounded like a flicker. Its call was like a flicker. Hmm. But it had red on the head from the back of the shoulders to the top of the head, and then it stopped, unlike the red-bellied. That's my question, and thank you.
Tom Schultz, you want to offer a guess there?
Well, it's hard to ever be certain in the bird world, because birds can can move around unexpectedly and show up in strange places. But yeah, when you mentioned the ladderback effect, the barring across the back of white and black, I'm guessing. I sure think it's a red-bellied woodpecker is what you saw.
Well, Tom, remember he mentioned about the red coming up just the nape and back of the head and not all the way across. Well, the male has the red
right
across the entire crown and down the nape. It's the female. That would be my guess. And, I'm thinking it's certainly not improbable. You know, birds do move around, and we've had some very unusual sightings in Wisconsin, but woodpeckers in general are not known to wander all that far. I would say take another look at the female red-bellied woodpecker and see if that isn't what matches.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Ed. And Reed in Clintonville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, good morning, fellas. Say, as a kid growing up in Oshkosh, and I'm an old guy now, many years ago I used to go to the museum all the time. What great entertainment there was there. And they had a stuffed a passenger pigeon. And I knew the story and used to just go look at that bird every time I was in the museum. And in light of cloning technology today, would there ever be any interest in cloning the bird to, bring back at least a few of them? And one other question here quickly. Does heavy weather impact on bird movement? Boy, I tell you, today there's heavy, and then there's low. But I have not seen one bird this morning. So I'll just hang up and listen.
All right. Heavy, humid weather. What effect does that have? And then what about cloning a passenger pigeon? Tom, any comments on either one of those?
Well, as a matter of fact, there have been scientists the last several years who have been exploring this possibility, and they've been able to sequence the DNA of the passenger pigeon, and they were looking for a good bird to use as a parent, I suppose, for implanting DNA into, and the closest surviving relative they believe is the band-tailed pigeon. And so there's ongoing talk and differences of opinion about whether or not this is a good idea, and even if it is done, would the offspring, and it would take a number of generations to try a backcrossing to try to replicate an actual passenger pigeon. But could you ever release these birds, and would they ever survive in the wild? It's a very different world today.
Yeah,
landscape is much different from the time when the passenger pigeons were living over 100 years ago.
I guess the other question would be is, even if you can continue to back cross and you get 99+% maybe 44/100 on top of it, you're never going to be 100% passenger pigeon, and will those minor little differences somehow never quite make it what it was in terms of its actual behavior and the flocking and so forth? And can we really return something like that to the skies, even with the best science? And I think maybe that's the one poignant reminder is, you know, even the best science out there, we can't afford to lose species because we don't know if we can ever really bring them back.
Yep, absolutely. And see, his other question was
about the effect of heavy weather.
Oh, yes, heavy weather.
And it certainly does occur. I mentioned before how birds tend to move on weather fronts. And at times they're either chased out or they're grounded by heavy weather. Sometimes you get what's called a fallout when birds are, say, moving northward during migration, but then they run into a storm cell or something like that, and it grounds them. And then suddenly the next morning, the ground, the area will be just full of birds. So that does happen. But birds are pretty smart, and they do tend to avoid severe weather if they can.
Interesting Facebook question. Another interesting Facebook question from Gary. With the end of the passenger pigeon, how many other species increased due to more food or habitat, that sort of thing? Bill, any ideas?
Well, we do know the passenger pigeons lived mostly in that late summer and fall on what's called the mass crop, acorns, chestnuts. And when you had birds in the millions and even hundreds of millions, it was just a tremendous amount of food that they required, which is, of course, why they were on the move and flew so far each day just to feed themselves and young, and the big masses in migration had to keep moving. I guess they'd be like a vacuum cleaner on the forest floor. It's not a type of food that a lot of other birds take, however, but I'm sure that void probably provided some opportunity, probably the most abundant bird I can think of today. And it's not that it necessarily filled the niche of the pasture pigeon, but red-winged blackbirds have certainly exploded. And late fall, we see some tremendous flocks that go into these night roosts on some of the big marshes around Wisconsin. But I think they benefited from all the corn agriculture.
Susan from Cottage Grove wanted to know, again, on the passenger pigeon, how did a passenger pigeon get its name, passenger pigeon?
It's because of its migratory habit. It was a bird of passage. Tom, you want to add something to that?
That's my understanding also, Bill. Mm-hmm. Same reason. It's not directly obvious otherwise.
Perhaps, you know, 100 years ago, the English language may have been used a little differently, too.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Kenneth and Ladysmith has something for us. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi. Just a comment about the Baltimore Orioles. This summer, I've had two or three families of Baltimore Orioles, and they really eat the grape jelly. I mean, they've been great all summer. They're just fun to watch. That was just a comment.
Oh, thanks, Ken. Darn it.
Some people would love to have that problem.
Yes, some of us would really love to have that problem. I've got, you know, I've in preparation, I've got, I don't know how many jars of grape jelly. And that I bought a few extras. There was a sale on them at the store, and I thought, well, I better stock up. So I've got a bunch of jars of grape jelly that are plumb full.
Well, good thing it's got a good shelf life for next year.
Hopefully next year, yeah.
An interesting thing with the grape jelly or oranges that people put out, or for myself, now it's the hummingbird feeders that they're hitting. They don't all do that. I've tried grape jelly here, and in a way, they almost turn their noses up. I can't really seem to entice them. They certainly like the sweet stuff one way or another, but I think it's almost like an individual habit that some of them get a bit of a taste for it or develop a habit. And I've known people who say that it's actually getting to be expensive to keep up with all of the Baltimore Orioles and the grape jelly that they devour. Here, I can hardly give it away. But the hummingbird feeders, we're filling them every other day. They're just pounding that. So it's really interesting. By you, Larry, you said you hear them around the neighborhood, but they're not coming to the feeder. Now, yep. Is it that they're just not, or that you're not located right in their feeding area, or that this particular group of birds just doesn't have a taste for it.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I'm going to move my feeder next year to a little different spot on our property. I mean, we don't have that big a property, but I think there may be a spot that'll turn out to be a better spot. I'm going to try that next year. So we'll have a report on it. I can tell you that. I'll make sure that I talk about it. As we visit today with Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz, our birding experts, I forgot to mention earlier, but 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn learns about a new international survey that finds U.S. teachers report high levels of job satisfaction while at the same time believe that the profession is undervalued. So they'll talk about that at 1 o'clock today. But right now, we're zeroing in on those birds that we see around Wisconsin as this the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon. With our two guests, Tom Schultz and Bill Volkert. Polly in Heartland has a question for you guys. Polly, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious to know what your guests' comments are on the number of migratory birds and other birds that are being killed in the wind farms and solar farms across the United States. And the fact that the United States government has actually lifted the ban on the wholesale slaughter of protected species as long as they're killed over the wind farms or the solar farms.
Solar farm, just as sort of an aside, I didn't realize that there was any mortality occurring on solar farms. But
that's something out of California, and these are these large kind of industrial operations where what they're doing is out in the desert, they've got mirrors that are all focused onto a sort of central operation system which boils the water, turning into steam and turning the turbines. So they've got acres and acres of mirrors, and there have been a couple of cases of birds flying through there and literally going up in flames in the air as they're going through this intensively magnified sunlight. So that's an entirely new thing. Wind farms, well, yeah, we do know that certain turbines, particularly some of the early ones in California, were very devastating to the migratory raptors, the eagles and hawks. We continue to evaluate the different kinds of wind farm operations that are going up. And I've always said different birds fly in different ways so that some will be more vulnerable than others. I guess the degree of impact is probably less than we may have anticipated on those large wind turbines. But as we put more and more of them up, it's just another hazard. And, you know, as Tom said, birds fly at night. And if you put up any structure high enough and possibly in the route of migratory birds, it's always a potential obstacle. We know that communication towers and high-rise buildings certainly can be deadly. And we just have more and more tall structures out there. It just adds to the mix.
Yeah.
Some structures can be made safer, say communication towers and so forth, by not having lights on them that are on steadily, because those often will attract birds in migration. They'll tend to circle around those towers and often hit the guy wires then, because it's, as I said before, it's nighttime and they're not able to see those as well. And so if you have a flashing type or strobe light, it's better from that standpoint. But certainly it is the cause of a certain amount of mortality for birds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Larry, you know, as we're looking at the passenger pigeon and its demise and the threats of on different birds these days, I think my big concern is the passenger pigeon was pretty obvious what happened. I mean, it was just this aggressive hunting of people that literally wiped the birds out in one way or another. For a lot of our birds today, it's usually not one single cause and effect for many of them. DDT was an unusual one for eagles. We could easily identify that, rectify it, and the birds have come back tremendously. But my bigger concern is the multiple impacts. And by that I mean the loss of habitat here, as well as down in the wintering grounds in the tropics, the tall structures, the invasive species that are changing the quality of habitat, chemicals in the environment, And as I've mentioned to a lot of people over the years, what's really affecting our birds today, it's D, all the above, and it's this compound. At what point does the world get to be so dangerous and uninviting that bird populations just struggle to maintain themselves and have a hard time keeping their numbers? And so it's more the rare case, I think, these days where you have a simple cause and effect that we do this, these birds are affected, and that's why they're disappearing. But it's these increasing multiple pressures from all sides that's just making it tougher and tougher. And with so many different species out there, some are having a harder time than others.
Yeah. Just to go along with that, we had a Facebook question from Lisa who wanted you guys to speak about the effects of lead shot on birds and other wildlife. She overheard a conversation where a bird hunter claimed that was baloney because the birds were still around.
Well, we've known since the 1920s that lead is a toxin to wildlife. It took until 1992 when we banned lead for overwater use across the United States. And even nowadays, California is struggling because lead shot is still being used. It's slowly being phased out in many areas. But for big game hunting and even bullet fragments seem to be incredibly lethal to the California condor. There's no doubt that lead is toxic to birds. Probably the biggest event we had in Wisconsin was 1978. We had a massive goose die-off to the northwest of Horicon Marsh, which made big news, and there were always there the tremendous doubters. It had to be something else. What Wisconsin finally did is we collected 50 carcasses, sent them to Fort Collins, Colorado, and said, here, you do an independent test. Came back 100%. It's lead. Some species are more vulnerable than others, so California condors and really big birds like trumpeter swans, one or two pellets is all it takes, and it can kill those birds.
Wow.
Others seem to be able to take a little bit more of a load, but it's certainly it's not good for them.
We have lots of other callers online. Still one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller, Bill Volkert, and Tom Schultz. Our guests today, Bill, a retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, Tom Schultz, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and very well-known wildlife artist. Our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz, talking birds as we always do. We try to, on every holiday, we try to do a bird show. It's always fun for me, and Tom and Bill have done a marvelous job helping us identify birds and also talk about really what's going on this time of year as we get into the fall migration period. Always fun to have them with us, and certainly join in with your questions or comments. You can call us 800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. As a matter of fact, even if you've got a photo, a bird photo, we'd love to see it. There have been some really good photos posted already. Actually, one from Charles isn't a bird at all, but it's one of the solar panels that we were talking about earlier. But then there are some pretty good photos There's some pretty good photos, one of a northern goshawk and a couple of loon shots that are fun to see and interesting to see as well. So please join in. Take a look at the Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for that. And David in Minneapolis, Minnesota, up next. David, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, it's great to be on. I'm grieving a bit to hear that this is the anniversary of Martha's passing. That was a tragedy. I work full time on the issue of human population pressure, overpopulation, and the good news is that overpopulation is solvable. And of course, we all know, birders know, that overpopulation, human activity, human pressure is really driving a lot of this problem. So I would invite your guests and your listeners to go to worldpopulationbalance.org, our website, and look about ways that they can get involved to help actually to humanely solve human overpopulation pressure that's really driving a lot of these challenges.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill, any comment?
Well, I guess just simply looking at the basic laws of ecology, we know that for any animal population, there are always upper limits. We've always said that you can't stockpile wildlife. There's only going to be so much food, water, shelter for them. And those same rules and laws apply to us. It's only so big of a planet. And I guess it stands to reason that the more you have a demand for one species, the less there is left over oftentimes for others. And if we're going to share this planet and continue to do so with the 10,000 different kinds of birds that nature put here, we're the only ones who have that consciousness to realize what's going on. And as I've said for a long time, we are the source of all of the environmental problems these days. The good news, we're also the only solution.
Lucille in Kewaunee County has something for you guys. Hi, Lucille. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having your program. I love it. I just wanted to make a comment and see. About 2 weeks ago, I saw a bird that looked like a Gala woodpecker, and I watched it for 2 days only, and that's supposed to only be on the California coast. Is that a possibility? In this area, I'm in the edge of Brown County and Kewaunee County.
Okay.
I'm guessing you probably mean Gila woodpecker, G-I-L-A?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Okay.
G-I-L-A.
Yeah.
There aren't any records in Wisconsin that I'm aware of a Gila woodpecker, but...
This was about 2 weeks ago, and it was only here for about 2 days. I don't have a camera or anything, so I couldn't take a picture.
And the Gila woodpecker is a somewhat recent split from the flicker family. So maybe take a close look at flicker, see if that isn't what you had. Right now, with the young out, sometimes they can look a little scruffy before they get the full plumage. So sometimes when you look at your field guide, when you're in late summer, you get some young out there who don't have a perfect plumage. And that sometimes it gets a little hard to find a good picture of that in a book.
Yeah.
And some hybrids do show up in Wisconsin, especially with the western form of the flicker, which has red shafts in the wings and tail. We have the yellow-shafted flicker here in this part of the country, and sometimes you see birds that have orange shafts or maybe some of both red and yellow, and presumably they're hybrids with that western subspecies.
So that's possible, too. So there you go. Thanks, Lucille. Mary in the town of Lebanon. Hi.
Hi. Well, we had some exciting bird news on about the 10th of August. We saw two prosonotary warblers. And somebody talked about the effect of the weather. We have an enormous lilac bush, and they all like to come when the weather is kind of cold and windy and sit near our house. And so they were right on our deck railing a number of days. So now, that was real fun.
Prothonotary warbler. Now, Tom, maybe you could describe that for us.
Well, it's kind of a special bird in Wisconsin. A lot of people don't get to see them because their habitat range is fairly restricted. They're mostly found in floodplain forests, in the southern part of the state. Do you live near a river?
Yeah, we're in the floodplain of the Rock River. I don't know what. We're in the town of Lebanon, and we had an awful lot of flooding here. And when we have flooding, we get like 100 acres of land underwater. So.
Yeah,
that sounds perfect.
And so it was really exciting because my husband was an naturalist at River Edge, so we know what we saw.
Yeah, that is very cool. Thank you for calling. So those sightings aren't – that's something you probably might want to put up online, eh?
Yeah, it's interesting and to know where their range is in Wisconsin. The prothonotary warbler, a description of it would be a brilliant yellow bird, almost with the male has almost had orangey tones on the head. The yellow is so intense, and then gray, kind of blue gray on the wings. Mm-hmm. So it's a beautiful, striking bird.
If you were going to report that, you can go online. There's a place to really sightings of interesting birds, isn't there?
There, if you're on Facebook, there's certainly the Wisconsin Birding Facebook page. That's one option. But eBird is a great
eBird. That's what I was trying to think of, and the name couldn't. I couldn't call it up. So eBird. You know.
eBird, and it's very easy to become a member of eBird. There's no fee involved at all. All you need is a username and password, and then you can enter your sightings depending on where you're looking at birds. But it's a tremendous database of birds from across North America, in fact, all of the world at this point. And birders all over submit their checklists, and there are some reviewing that occurs for rare species. So it's generally fairly reliable, but you can go on the eBird website and you can generate range maps and for different seasons of the year, or migration charts to show when the birds are most to be expected. It's a great resource.
I'm going to have to go online and just call up a photo of a prothonotary warbler, because I don't. I'm pretty sure if I saw one, I didn't know what I was seeing. And I just, now I'm really intrigued when I hear that bright yellow color. Mary, thank you. Appreciate it.
We also were fortunate to see a Harris sparrow this spring came through, and that was the first time we'd ever sighted one.
A Harris sparrow as well. Very cool. Good for you, Mary. You're living a good spot.
We do get reports every year in Wisconsin. They're heading up into the northern central Canada, sort of toward the edge of the tree line. And out into the, they come up the prairie states. So we're on the far eastern edge. But every year we get a couple showing up here, so we're not in the main line of travel for them. But enough people watching around the state, we always find a few of them here and there.
Thanks again, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Liz and Viroqua a chance to join in. Liz, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, you're welcome. And I have 80 acres outside of Viroqua, 40 acres of which are woods. And I lure my orioles in with the grape jelly, and then they destroy all the caterpillars on any trees in the woods.
Oh, sure.
Because they don't just eat jelly or fruit. Huh. They eat worms, and they're all over the trees. They're destroying all the caterpillars on the trees, which I don't think are butterfly caterpillars, by the way.
Yeah.
So they nest here every single year because I've got 40 acres of insects for them to eat. They don't just eat fruit or jelly.
Well, actually, the fruit or jelly is kind of an exception for them. They must have a bit of a sweet tooth, so to speak, or beak. But they're primarily insect eaters. And, of course, for rearing their young, that has a lot of that fat and protein that they need for growth. So that is their main food. And I think of the grape jelly as sort of well, kind of like a drive-through. It's quick, it's easy, it's there. You take advantage of it. I don't know if you can live on it. But, you know, it's certainly convenient, and we can lure them in. And that's the nice thing about it, that in summertime, because of so much insect food, the birds don't need the bird feeders. But great to lure them in where we can see them and bring them out of the trees and out of that dense foliage so they're visible, and maybe even where we see them bring their young in.
Yeah, I like to have those feeders going. Well, we have two cats. They're both indoor cats. We don't let our cats outside. Partly because of birds, they're predatory to birds, or would be if we let them out. But they enjoy looking at the birds, but they're on one side of the window and the birds are on the other.
And Liz, you make a great point about the beneficial aspects about birds and the services that they provide, ecological services in terms of eating pests. If we didn't have birds, caterpillars would take over our plants. They would eat all the leaves. They really save us an awful lot of money in pesticides and other sorts of pest control. So it's great to have birds around in the landscape.
There's actually been a good point, Tom, and there's been a number of attempts in for forest communities and for agricultural areas to try to actually put a dollars and cents on those services that birds provide, of what they save for us. I mean, it's hard to put a dollar on it, but it is literally in the hundreds of millions that we're saving because of what the birds do out there to keep things in balance for us.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Liz. Rich in St. Germain. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to let all your listeners know that there's a quote by John Muir. I don't know if I have it totally correct, but he says if you tug on one thing in nature, you'll find it's attached to everything else. And that, you know.
I think that's fairly close to what he said, isn't it, Bill?
Yeah, he has, certainly has the gist. I don't know if I can do any better job to get the exact words, but that's essentially it, that everything in the universe is connected, and if we pull on one thing, we'll find that it's, you know, attached to everything else.
Yeah.
And where John Muir was writing with a naturalist vision, but very much in a prose style, what he did was to anticipate what the scientists and ecologists would certainly verify later on, that, yeah, everything is connected out there in nature, which also is kind of a warning for us. You've got to watch a little bit when we start doing anything in the environment, because it's not always a single event that we may affect.
Alexandra in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you very much. Memorial weekend, I bought a finch feeder, and I was getting this little bag of Niger seed, and my son said, oh, why don't you get the big bag? And I think I'm stuck with a lifetime supply because none of the seed has moved, and I'm visually impaired, and I can't go online to get the information that I need. So I would appreciate your input on that. And are there any other birds besides the finches that eat Niger seed?
There are some that do eat the Niger seed, but unfortunately, if you buy too much of it, sometimes it'll tend to go rancid before you can use it all up or moldy. So
you're probably looking at getting rid of it, Alexandra. So thank you for calling. And just a reminder, Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz are guests today. And they're going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Whether we know almost nothing about them or maybe you've been studying them for your whole life, birds are fascinating, aren't they? They really add a lot to our Wisconsin landscape. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today as we talk birds with our two guests. Lucky to have two experts, Bill Volkert, one of them, has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years. He spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. Bill, always great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Really appreciate it. Tom Schultz with us, well-known wildlife artist. He's illustrated several field guides to birds. He is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, a member of the steering committee for the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And Tom, as always, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And as we broke for news, we had a question about Niger seed and a follow-up. People wondering about non-finch birds that might eat Niger seed. And you also had another comment, Tom, about what we could do with that seed.
I was going to add that, goldfinches tend to be the ones that use the tube feeders where you normally feed Niger seed or maybe a Niger sock. But I've also found that if you scatter Niger seed on the ground, a lot of the non-feeder type birds, the sparrows in particular, will eat those seeds also. So that might be a good option to just spread it around, and you may attract some interesting sparrows.
All right. So sparrows will eat Niger seed as well. Something else to think about. Kathy in Oshkosh has a question for you. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Tom.
Yes.
Hello, Bill. And hello, Larry.
Hi.
My comment perhaps was brought up a little bit earlier than when I tuned in, but I wanted to comment about the many different birds we've seen here and some of the activity, some good and some bad. In the spring, of course, we had lots of visitors to the lard we put out with many, many types of woodpeckers visiting. And we put out a hummingbird feeder. We put out the tube-type feeder and a finch feeder. And the birds you would expect to see at the finch feeder were numerous. And we were very happy to have two of those placed close to the house. We're on the lake, so we do see quite a variety of birds visiting. And we have a tube-type adjustable perch tube feeder that we put seed in, and we were seeing quite a variety of birds on there as well. Then we put out jelly and oranges for the orioles. What happened was disturbing and frustrating And that is that the first year we did this, we saw the birds we expected to see. And eventually the red-winged blackbirds and the starlings took over almost every feeder that we had and kept the birds we wanted to see on them, like the lard, and even the finch feeder and the seed feeder, they would take over and scare the other birds away. Eventually, we were able to adjust the tube feeders so that the weight of the bird would not allow it to feed at the tube feeder. I'm sure you know the type I'm speaking mm-hmm. of.
I have a couple of them.
Yes, those work well for that. But the starlings are social feeders. They decided that when they watch the orioles, I guess, eat oranges and jelly, that they should eat it too. So they could eat us out of several squeezed bottles of jelly in a week. And the same with the lard. They would go through, I don't know what size the lard packets are, but they could go through one in a day. So my question is there a way to stop mm-hmm. them? Or do they come all winter? Now that they know it's there, the first year, as I mentioned, was great, but once they discovered it, it seems like I see them all the time. And when we adjusted the seed feeder, they've stayed away from that. But even, believe it or not, the starlings tried the jelly. And, of course, the sparrows are all over that. They believe that's their food now.
Yeah. So, Bill, you want to start with you?
Well, that's always a challenge, is how do you lure in the birds that you really want to see and keep the others away? I've had a couple of families of grackles coming to my seed feeders, and other birds do visit and take their turns, but no doubt the grackles are probably eating 75% of the food we put out every day. It gets a little tough sometimes when you get a few very hungry and aggressive birds that are coming there. But it was already was hinted, by changing the variety of food you offer, sometimes it can be a little restricted. So the generalists that take the larger sunflower seeds and mixed seed, if you go to the tube feeder, that certainly sometimes restricts who can have access to it. So if you play with that a little bit, that oftentimes does it. If you end up, you've got a problem that they're just coming in and eating out of house and home and you're not seeing anything else, you can always shut the feeder down for a bit and see if those birds don't disperse. Keep in mind, and this is also to answer one of the Facebook questions, somebody asked here, if I stop feeding, if I go on vacation, will the birds starve? The birds get most of their food from nature. They always will. It's more of a convenience that they're coming to your feeder. And so if you want to shut it down and let them go back and search for their own food, that might help a little bit. They may disperse, the ones that you don't want to lure in, and you might want to start over again. That's also a good trick that works if you've got a hawk that's hunting your feeder and taking some of your favorite birds. They got to eat too, of course, but sometimes you feel like you're setting them up that way. So that's another alternative.
All right.
Yes, we've tried that. Thank you. And we'll change up the feed a little bit. We've tried taking it away for a while. I'm just afraid once we put out the lard that they'll be back in a heartbeat because they love it.
Yeah, it's likely that could happen. You may need to leave it a couple of weeks.
Yeah, give it a little bit of time. Or perhaps if you've got some resident starlings that are just going to be waiting every time you put it out, maybe just excluded from the diet. And I guess that's sometimes the kind of paradox of bird feeding. There are people who put out feeders and hope something comes, and all of a sudden when they show up and you can't keep up with their appetite or the birds that you don't want to feed are there, all of a sudden you've created a bit of a problem that you've got too many birds coming in. You're too successful. But I guess that's the nature of bird feeding.
Thanks a lot for calling, Kathy. Appreciate it. Oh, we have a Facebook comment from Linda, who says, speaking of the importance of conservation, can you mention the Whooping Crane Festival, celebrating the return of an endangered species coming up? And the festival is September 13th And Tom, you're going to be speaking at that, are you not?
I am, yes. This is taking place in Princeton, Wisconsin, which is in Green Lake County. And we've had a festival for whooping cranes the last few years, but it's been up in Berlin at the Conservation Club. And this is a new site. It's going to take place, most of the activities at the Princeton High School, starting on Friday evening. But the main focus of activities will be on Saturday.
Yeah, and you're speaking, and Stan Temple from the UW, wildlife ecologist, noted wildlife ecologist, George Archibald, and others. So,
a lot of good speakers.
Yeah, lots of good speakers. So that's something, the Whooping Crane Festival, I bet if you just go online to Whooping Crane Festival and put the date in, you're going to get some more information about it.
If you go on the Operation Migration website, operationmigration.org, there'll be a link there where you can get more information about the festival and possibly go out and see, observe the whooping crane training with the ultralights, which takes place at White River Marsh just north of Princeton, about 3 miles north. So,
oh, cool. That would be fun to see.
Neat opportunity.
Carl in Madison, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the program. Your comments earlier about, is it the promontory warbler?
Prothonotoria.
Yeah, thank you. My son and I were walking in the Pheasant Branch Conservancy near Middleton, and there was a birder that was there with his binoculars, and he was crouched over, and we were watching him, and he was watching something. And he said, take a look at this. And we saw this beautiful bird, this warbler that you're describing, and it looked more like a light bulb hanging in the bush than anything else. It was so bright and so beautiful. And I went home with my son later and looked it up, and I guess that the first term comes from the hood of some official in the Catholic Church. It's that color, yellowish-orange, that draws the name. But in addition to that, I just wanted to say that, you know, in terms of where we are in this world, in the critical times we live in terms of what we're going to protect, you know, we tend to protect what we love, and we love what we understand, and we understand only what we have the opportunity to learn about. So I just want to thank you for the program, and thank your guests for giving people the opportunity to just learn a little bit more about the natural world around them, in hopes that maybe that'll push us in the direction to save this glittering world before it's gone. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Carl, thank you so much. And, of course, I want to thank Bill and Tom for taking time on this holiday to do that. Bill, you've been doing it for how many years have we been doing this together?
Oh, gosh, I think we started somewhere about 87.
1987.
Yeah,
1987,
right?
Wow. Yeah, that's I'm trying to
do
the math.
Been a long time, Larry.
I'm trying to do the math in my head here, but sounds like 27 years or so to me.
It's been a great stretch, and I've enjoyed every time that we've been able to get together, and I appreciate you having us on. Holidays just wouldn't be a holiday without doing these shows with you. Thank you
so much. And, Tom, thank you so much. It's been a couple times now for you, and we really have enjoyed having you. And we're not winding the show up now, but with Carl's comments, I thought it was appropriate just to say to say thanks.
And I guess I go to add what both for Tom and myself and many other people, our good friend Noel Cutright, who I did the show with for a number of years, his comment was, well, we do all this for the holidays, and he said, I just wish there were more holidays.
Yeah. Bob, and again, Carl, thank you so much for your thoughts. Bob in Minocqua.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Looked out this morning at the lake, and I saw something swim by, so I took my field glasses, went down, and it was 6 female common mergansers. Now, I usually see mergansers the first bird in the spring, but I don't see them in the fall. I don't know if this is a sign of an early winter or not.
Probably not all females. Those could be the young of the year. They won't have that full breeding plumage of the male till we go through the winter and in the next spring. So possibly what you've got is a brood with a female with her young.
Okay, that could be because one of the larger ones, she caught a very big fish, and the other 5 really scampered over after her. Took her.
Well, there you go. Yeah, she's still teaching them how to do the fishing. Yeah, you probably had a local nesting on top of They mostly nest in Canada, but we do have some in the northern part of the states, a little bit of nesting here and there. So, yeah, very likely. You've got a family. Good for you.
Good for you. Yeah,
the thing is, Niger feeder, the finches knock it down, and then as it the snow slowly melts away from all the piles, the jonquils come and take care of it, too. So
there you go. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. Oh, mergansers. That's one thing I've always enjoyed in the spring on the you know, being in the Madison area, the Madison Lakes, we always see some mergansers coming through, and it's always a pleasure to see them early in the spring once the snow, the ice goes away from Lake Monona.
And we have three species of mergansers, the common being the largest,
yeah,
the red-breasted, and the much smaller hooded.
Yeah.
An interesting little comment on your Facebook page of somebody enjoying a smaller hooded merganser eating, he says, a 6-inch perch. It's quite the meal for a small bird like that.
Oh, man. Well, see, now I've got to go back and click and take a look at that. Our Facebook page is, if you're near your computer, you might go to my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and then recent posts, which you'll see over on the left side of your screen. Click on that, and you're going to get a whole batch of really cool outdoor bird photos.
And speaking of which, there is a question here. Somebody said they recently moved and wanted to know if it's a little late to put out hummingbird and oriole feeders. And right now, these birds are getting ready for migration, and we also have migrants coming from northern Wisconsin and southern Canada coming in. So it's not just the local pair that you might be able to feed, but also birds that are coming through, stopping your backyard, fueling up, and getting ready to go. It's not too late. It's a good time to put them out and help them on their way.
I see Diane just posted one of an oriole at her. Eating an orange out of a flower pot. And there's probably some more here, and I can't find them now when I want to look at them. Rich in East Troy has something for us, so we should go there. Rich, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I just, on a sad note, I used to use those steel tube feeders for finches.
Yeah.
A couple of times last time I used them, the finches would get their heads stuck in them, and they would die, unfortunately.
Oh!
And I just quit using the steel tube feeders and just warn anybody out there, stop using them.
Oh, you know, I've used two of them for years, and I have never had, a problem.
Must be a poor,
yeah, I had two of them in 1 year.
Yeah, oh my goodness, yeah, and, well, that's certainly something to think about. It could be the type. Bill, you're right. It could be the type of tube.
All you really need is just a small hole or slit so that the feed isn't spilling out and the birds sort of pick it and pull it. They don't have to have something deep and recessed. That's apparently what this design is, that they're reaching in to grab the seed. That's not that necessary. So, yeah, don't rule out all tube feeders. You just have one that's a poor design. Get something different.
Thanks again, Rich. Patty in Door County, up to you now. Thanks, Patty.
Hi, it is a great day in Door County, and thank you for your wonderful show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be redoing my deck in the next few weeks, and interestingly enough, I've had bluebird feeders out, but no bluebirds ever in them, but they've nested now underneath my deck because there's these beautiful little areas, and I have three nests, and I have babies, teenager bluebirds, and I'm wondering what should I do about, the nests and cleaning my deck.
Are you saying that the bluebirds are nesting at present?
Well, yes, I think that's what they are, the bluebirds, and yes, and they're nesting there, and I've got the birds are not full mature yet.
Yeah. Wow, so that's a late,
very late brood.
Really late brood. Well, you'd want to probably wait until they leave, wouldn't you, Tom?
And I would think it would be fairly soon.
Yeah,
it's getting late in the season now, and if the birds are too young, they're just not going to make it.
Yeah. Bill, what do you think?
Well,
they're out of line.
It's always recommended for people to clean out the nest boxes at the end of the season, or do it early next spring as the birds are just arriving. they naturally will rebuild the nest. It's a little kind of part of that courtship and nesting behavior, for one. They like to tidy things up and get ready. And there's oftentimes a chance for parasites to be remaining in the old nest material, which may go after the young. So, yeah, clean them out at the end of the season when it's all done.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. So it shouldn't be any problem at all
to do
your deck cleaning. Yep. But I'd, you know, just wait till they're, and they're going to be gone, as Tom says. They got to be out of getting out of there pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's exceptional to be this late, but it's always a good late fall task or very early spring.
Yep, absolutely. John and Mason, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I actually have two. One is a question, one's a comment. The first one is, I have a pair of hummingbirds that come every spring and nest somewhere around my house. And if I don't put the hummingbird feeder out right away, then they buzz by my window to get my attention. They'll let me know, hey, put the hummingbird feeder up. But we all know how herbicides and pesticides decimate bees and butterflies. What about hummingbirds? Because if they go to a flower that's been treated and then they take it back to the nest and feed the young, that would wipe out the whole family, wouldn't it?
Bill?
Well, it would depend on the kind of chemical, whether or not it's something that could be, say, translocated in that food, and whether it persists, you know, right in the flower with the nectar. So, you know, that has to do with the chemistry and application of the particular chemical itself. So, otherwise, contaminated food and the impacts to birds, yeah, chemicals certainly are another factor that are a concern. You know, we just don't find dead birds or suffering birds usually that are out there, you know, as they're in their death throes. They usually kind of disappear, head out into the bushes, into shelter somewhere because they feel weak and vulnerable, and just disappear unseen. That's why we really, what we're doing is we're monitoring the bird populations to see how well they're doing year after year, and we look for trends of increase and decrease.
Yeah.
Overall, hummingbirds seem to be doing quite well, and as far as the population in general, it's not a real concern. They seem to be hanging in there quite well. And then for myself, we had a real banner year of hummingbirds here again.
Yeah, I read somewhere that they have a lifespan of about 10 years.
They can, yeah, can live to be that long. And that's from actually marking individuals. Of course, like a lot of the birds, that first year is the toughest, so we can have really high mortality. 50% or more may not make it through the first year. After that, they stand a good chance of living for a number of years and can live to 10 or more. The average is probably less than that. I guess like humans, you know, we can live to over 100. Most of us won't make it.
John, thank you very much for calling. Just a quick note that Gene in a Facebook comment, we were talking about what birds eat Niger seed. She has indigo buddings in the spring that eat the Niger seed, and right now she says the chickadees are constantly emptying her Niger feeder these days. So there you go, indigo buddings and chickadees.
Mm-hmm.
And guys, it's been a real pleasure as always. Thank you so much. I hope I hope we can do this again.
I certainly
Absolutely.
Hope we as well. Thanks so much, Larry.
Thank you so much. Bill Volker, naturalist. Retired from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Tom Schultz, a well-known wildlife artist and past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. We'll have him back, and we will definitely do this again. And I want to thank you. Peter Green of Infostar.com joins me on tomorrow to talk about the world of software and computers. In the meantime, happy birthday again to my daughter, Emily, and happy birthday to you, and happy Labor Day to everybody here on the Ideas Network.